welcome it to Shattering Mist. Yes, one of the reasons that I took the time to write the chapters on Rome, beyond the fact that Yao spoke a great deal about the plague that was and will continue to be Rome, that would be the Roman Empire, followed by the Roman Catholic Church, in his prophecy through Daniel, is that the more I studied why God was so antagonistic towards the Roman Catholic Church and the Empire of Rome, the Empire of Rome, by the way, the manifestation of it as an empire, as a nation, as a military regime has more in common with the United States than any other nation on earth. The United States uses the Roman symbols. We use the Roman terminology. We even talk about the Roman Senate. We use the same eagle as our national symbol. And we even talk about being a republic. The terms. Go ahead.
There are Roman fasces on either side of the podium at the House of Representatives.
Yes.
The Senate meets on Capitol Hill. Roman
yes.
Senate and on Capitoline Hill.
Yes.
Yeah,
exactly. Yeah, it's through and through. We are, in fact, even in our national rhetoric on our symbols, we write all of it in Latin, the language of the Roman Empire. Literally everything that America represents in terms of its approach to its military and how the president is the commander of in chief, just as the emperor was. All of it is Roman in origin. But the religion of Rome has become the Roman Catholic Church. And Yahweh is disgusted by both of them. But when I wanted to figure out why, I began to study Roman history. And beyond just looking at the vicious, immoral nature of Rome and the caste system of Rome, in the military, of course, of Rome, one of the things that struck me was how evil, how duplicitous, how hypocritical, how ruthless the emperors were of Rome, beginning with Julius Caesar and running through Theodosius, which was the fellow that established the feudal order that was so hellish on Europe for better part of 1,000 years. And when you do that, one of the things that you find is that if you want to know what the Torahless one, whom Christians call the Antichrist, is going to be like, just look at the Roman emperors. I mean, he's going to have a lot of Nero, a lot of Caligula, a lot of Claudius, a lot of Vespasian, a lot of Titus, and if you were to pick... Yeah, but if you were to pick a single individual, Hadrian would be the individual most akin to the fellow known as the Antichrist in almost every aspect of his persona, including the fact that Hadrian was also homosexual. His greatest tragedy in life is when his lover boy died, and Hadrian was an initiate in the Dionysus religious sect in Greece, and would constantly go to Greece to participate in the Dionysian celebrations, which were almost identical to the celebrations the Roman Catholic Church now hosts for Easter. Hadrian is the perfect prototype. You want to know what he's going to be like? Look at Hadrian. That's the nature of him, and Hadrian did exactly what you were talking about. Hadrian broke his promise, and what his ultimate plan was for Jerusalem. Not only would it be a shrine to himself and named after him, but it was first and foremost going to be a retreat for the soldiers of the Roman Legion. It would be a place where the soldiers of the Roman Legion, because it was the crossroads of the world, it was the perfect location, where soldiers of the Roman Legion could take their time off. They could have their parties and celebrate. It was going to be a place where warriors would be celebrated and honored.
Right. Now, in terms of the eschatological expectations for the Temple Mount. I mean, you had the Jewish group to call the Temple Mount faithful, which, you know, at least for the longest time, annually, they would take a foundation stone up on a truck to try and place it up on the Temple Mount. They've sold out the red heifer. They've manufactured implements for the temple cultists and all that sort of thing. Now, they are a very much a very tiny fringe group, and certainly the government is unpacking.
Yeah, and by the way, I am absolutely convinced. Now, I would say my confidence level's in the 99 percentile that men are not going to build the temple that Yahweh is going to arrive and hang around during the Yom Kippurim and Sukkah for 1,000 years. He's going to build it. And the first thing he's going to do is he's going to destroy Jerusalem as we know it. There's going to be a massive earthquake followed by a massive tsunami. And the combination of the earthquake, which will level everything, and the tsunami, which will carry all the debris away, even if man were to have built a temple, it's gone.
Yeah.
And so the very first thing he's going to do is he's going to level the place. He's going to wash it away, all the debris away. And while I'm certain of that, my gut tells me that he's actually going to build his temple right over the highest part of Mount Moriah. The highest part of Mount Moriah is where the Garden Tomb is currently. It sits right above the parking lot of the Jerusalem bus station. Under that parking lot is where the receptacle was for the upright pole upon which he hung. The Ark of the Covenant is in Jeremiah's grotto, directly beneath the Jerusalem bus station's parking lot, which you look up and you see you can still see it today, the markings of a skull against the embankment or the cliff that forms the eastern wall, if you will, of the highest peak of Mount Moriah. So the highest peak of Mount Moriah was not leveled for the Temple Mount. It still exists. It's where the Garden Tomb was. It is... it's against that embankment that the upright pole was placed. Jeremiah's grotto is directly beneath that. The Ark of the Covenant is right there. So I think that he's going to build his temple over those things.
Wow. Wow, that's the first I've heard that one. I've heard some of the other theories and, the various things favored by various academics and historians and that sort of thing. You know, such as the Dome of the Tablets site and all that sort of thing. But, wow, that's fascinating.
Yeah, if you look at the Temple Mount itself, it looks like the Muslims missed the mark with the Dome of the Rock and that it's not actually, neither it nor the Al-Aqsa Mosque are actually over the site of the temple. And so there are some that have proposed the idea that the temple could be built back with them standing. But that's not Yahweh's style. Yahweh's style is they will be absolutely, totally, and completely blown away. I mean, there won't be any trace of religion, much less Satan's religion, Islam, with anywhere on this planet, much less on the Temple Mount. And so there is there's a little. Almost like a gazebo that's on the Temple Mount now, which marks the area that the Holy of Holies was, the most set-apart area. And my understanding is that if you were to build the temple back on the same place, that you could put it there and it would be over that that gazebo that is sometimes called the Dome of the Spirits. Sometimes it has different names, but I don't think that's what's going to happen. I just don't see it. I see him building it over Mount Moriah, directly over where the Ark of the Covenant is now.
Interesting. Wow. While we're speculating about things future, if it's not too much of a digression, we could do this more some other time. But jumping 1,000 years forward, you know, beyond that, to the end of the millennium, okay, if you allow for a literal millennial reign and then the final battle and that sort of thing. In Revelation and the Apocalypse of, you know, John, where it speaks of new heavens and new earth, this is a big contention as well, whether the earth is renewed or whether there's literally a new earth with the new Jerusalem, you know, a city of 1,500 miles by 1,500 miles by 1,500 miles sort of extending from space. What is your take on all of that?
Okay. Well, my first preference is always the caveat that that anything that is in Greek text of what's called the Christian New Testament is highly suspect. The only two documents that I would even consider, and it may be two and a half that I would consider, Matanyah, because it was maintained in Hebrew for a considerable period of time, and Matanyah was an eyewitness. I think Matanyah is the most credible, most reliable document that is part of the so-called Christian New Testament. Second to that would be the Revelation to John, but anytime you move past the 15th chapter, you're highly suspect because we've got nothing prior to Constantine as a manuscript to do any verification. And the third, and it's only marginally so, is the book attributed to Yahu Kanan. And it's, Yahu Kanan, good guy, one of the disciples, to be sure, the scribe for Revelation. But unfortunately, his writings were heavily tampered with. And they were so heavily tampered with, it's really tough to know what he actually wrote and what has been said. Now, on top of all of that, you now have the problem of you read them in Greek, and yet everything that is said was spoken in Hebrew. And so when you're dealing with, for example, new versus renewed, and you're dealing with Greek versus Hebrew, it can be worded very differently in Greek versus Hebrew. You know, Hebrew, there is no such thing as past tense. There is no such thing as future tense, that time simply is. And so you have to be really careful with verbs. And if it was Hebrew, the verb that would be used would be kadash. And it would be reaffirmed and renewed as opposed to new.
Which comports with Old Testament, with the earth abide forever. It comports with that notion.
Yeah. Now, I'm going to take a different view. I'm going to take the view that that we're actually going to get a new universe, and I'm going to share with you why I think that is the case. And this is a fun departure, so I don't have any issue. We're talking about Jerusalem anyway, and this is the new Jerusalem, which is a hypercube. So let's talk about it. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. We're having a conversation with Glenn about the future of Jerusalem, since the present in Jerusalem is such a mess, infected as it is with the disease of Islam, and therefore deadly and contagious. What I see is that when the Hebrew says that the land is forever, the earth is forever, the word translated land and earth, same word, it's eretz. And it really means that which is material. And relative to, it either serves as that which is the material realm as opposed to the spiritual realm, to differentiate heaven and earth, the spiritual realm, shamayim, and the material realm, eretz. Or it is being used as a metaphor, as in Amar Eretz, the promised land. And as the promised land, it is eternal in the sense that the promised land is a symbol of living with God, of camping out with Him for all time. So I don't see what I'm going to tell you is in conflict, because that's how Eretz Olam, eternal land, is used. I think that that at the end of the millennial celebration of the of Shabbat, that and after the final rebellion of Hasatan, so that the mortals born during that 1,000-year period are afforded the same kind of choice as others have been, so they have a real choice of with Yahweh or not with Yahweh, because eternity is a long time to spend with somebody who doesn't like it and doesn't like God. I see Yahweh actually creating a new universe with us as witnesses. And the reason I see it that way, Glenn, is several fold. One is as a as a spiritual being, the essence that is most akin to what we will be like is light, according to Yahweh. On a photon of light, time is, which means that while you don't necessarily maneuver in time, you can explore all time at any time, as well as all places at any time. And so in the existing universe, there would be the ability for us to go back in time here on Earth and witness not only our bad behavior, but human bad behavior. And it would be sad for that to occur. And for us to witness that, there would be great sadness. I don't want to see my flaws. I don't want to see the kind of bad behavior that we're witnessing in Jerusalem. I don't want to be exposed to the kind of idiot that wrote this piece for Reuters. That would be depressing. And so I think Yahweh wants us to be completely liberated in time as a spiritual being, which means the only way that he can do that and for us to be wholly and completely entertained for all time and yet never be exposed to anything that is sorrowful is to allow us to be witnesses as he creates a new universe. And so I think that's what he's doing. And I think that the enclave for us to gather together, not only as we transition from the old universe to the new universe, but then throughout all time in the new universe, I think we're still going to be celebrating the seven times a year, and that Jerusalem will be the natural place to do it. And I think that the new Jerusalem is a hypercube. I think it's, you know, if you look at its dimensions, its dimensions do not suit mortal man confined by gravity, if you will, and it's going to be infinite in time, so it's a hypercube. That's how I see it. I hope I didn't confuse you more, but that's my views.
Well, no, its dimensions cause it to extend well above the atmosphere of the present Earth.
Correct.
You know?
Correct.
So,
correct.
You know. So,
right. Yeah. If you had to breathe, and if you were confined by gravity, light's not confined by gravity, and that you know, as a spiritual being, breathing is not necessary. Temperature change, you know, being minus 50 Celsius. Isn't going to bother you. And so the only way that the hypercube, even in its height dimensions before you get to the hypercube, just the height dimensions of the cube works,
right,
is it has to be designed for a spiritual being. It's not designed for a physical mortal being. And of course, that is infinite in time. So I just see the new Jerusalem as the enclave for which we will be able to gather when we gather to celebrate together, because otherwise I think we have the opportunity to go explore the universe independently and collectively, but we'll all gather together in the new Jerusalem. And it's in the new Jerusalem that there's no need for a sun, that Yahweh will provide the light. But there will be lots of suns, lots of stars, and lots of solar systems, and lots of galaxies throughout this new universe for us to explore. Stay with us, and we'll continue to talk about the possibilities of what is to come. We're talking with Glenn about the issues that are potentialities regarding what's going to happen in our future. And Glenn, you know, we know that that it's going to be Jews, not religious Jews, but racial Jews, that are going to be settled in the Promised Land, in Yisrael, in accordance with Yahweh's original Torah instructions. And that they're going to serve as administrators during the thousand-year period. And that the charter document is going to be the Torah. And that they are all going to have a complete and accurate copy of the Torah, literally written inside of them by Yahweh. Now, during that time, there will be a number of us goyim, and, you know, some of us goyim may actually be Yehudim and just don't know it, but there will be us goyim that I suspect are going to have the 7 years of the tribulation plus the 1,000 years of Sukkah to explore the existing universe. You know, and that's a fair amount of time that we're going to be able to explore the existing universe, and that we're going to have Yahweh's Torah, but lowercase t, teaching and guidance written inside of us, so we don't screw things up as we go off and venture forth. That's my my take on it. Now, there is something that helps to solidify that. One of the two thoughts is that, A, we have Yahweh's promise that there will be no sorrow in the celebration of eternity with him. So that precludes going back in time on this planet. And second, Yahusha and Mataniah made a very specific statement that I think doesn't make any sense apart from what I'm going to, what I've been sharing and am sharing, which is he said that every jot and tittle, every nuance of the Torah, every word, every letter of every word of the Torah is going to stay full and in effect unchanged in full force so long as the heavens and earth exist. Well, that is perfect for what we're talking about, because the existing Torah is the perfect mechanism for those who are living during the millennial Shabbat. And so it makes perfect sense. But once we move to eternity, then the existing Torah is not the ideal document, because it has things in it that record things that are sad, where we've acted badly, that would sadden us. And the existing Torah exists to guide us to Yahweh. All of those who survive this period are going to know Yahweh. It exists us to directs us to join the covenant family. We've all joined the covenant family. And so the purpose of the Torah as it currently exists is moot. But we have need for Yahweh's direction and teaching to be inside of us in terms of how to best maximize the opportunities that will be afforded to us in eternity. So
that almost
comports
with the concept of logos, in a sense, you know, the living word, you know, the Torah, and the intuitive guidance of the Ruach Kodesh on a continual basis.
Right.
And also, before we wrap up on this, I just wanted to make the point that in terms of these things, these future things and eschatology, Yahweh makes no requirement whatsoever in his covenant that we be, you know, that we know these things in order to know him and be in right relationship with him and be in covenant with him. So while it's interesting to learn about, it's not a requirement for redemption, if you will. It ain't so much what you know as who you know.
Correct. Of course. You know, what we're talking about here is fascinating if you're a member of the covenant, because what we're talking about here suggestive of how we're going to spend eternity. Yahweh tells us very little about this, and I suspect it's for two reasons, and there may be more. One reason is that he's not into bribery. Now, he did show Abraham what he was going to inherit through the covenant by taking him to the stars and showing him the nature of light. So we know that our eternity is going to be among the stars, and we're going to exist as light. So we do know that, but yet God's not any, you know, we know we're going to be perfected, enriched, empowered, perfected, and adopted.
Purified, yeah.
Yeah, all those things, we know that. But we inherit all that is God's to give, because he uses the term inheritance associated with the covenant and his covenant children all the time. Now, those are all great things, and I'm more than satisfied with those things. It isn't appropriate, I don't think, for God to go beyond it. For you know, in the Quran it talks about, you know, you get multiple virgins and rivers that flow with wine, and you lay down on comfy couches.
It's all carnal. All carnal.
Well, first of all, not only is that all carnal and has no appeal to me and no appeal to you, but beyond that, that's a depiction of a false god trying to sell heaven to somebody who's laying on the dirt, who has insufficient water to drink and is too dumb or too ugly to attract a spouse. And so Iowa isn't going to tell us that we got really comfy couches there. He's not going to tell us that, you know, we're going to be really rich and powerful there. He's not trying to bribe us. You know, if you like him and you like the idea of being part of his family and spending a lot of time exploring with him, and if you like learning, then sign up. If you're interested in power and riches, don't sign up.
Well, plus, and right, and I think we're also talking about things such as alleviation of the sense of guilt associated with knowing that you've fallen short of the mark, you know?
Absolutely.
You're free from that sense. You're in God's presence with love, joy, and peace at all times.
Right,
you know?
Right.
That alone, I mean, like, you know me, I'm always like, I'm not that big on travel. So it's like,
yeah.
I don't know, you know, I'm sure my perspective on everything will change in Yahweh's presence, you know, but like at the moment, I'm like, I'm kind of a homebody. So,
you know, by the way, I want to be careful here. I don't think that your perspective on everything will change. I think the uniqueness of what makes you, you, the aspects of your character that are intertwined in your soul, I think are going to stay. I think that's what's going to make heaven interesting, is that it's going to be filled with people with different perspectives and different personalities and different approaches. And if somebody is super adventurous and somebody is a homebody, then there's opportunities to get to know the both have benefits. You know, home is going to be really cool. So,
I identify with Dode saying that he wants to be a pillar in Yahweh's temple forever. It's like,
yeah.
I just want to be, like, whatever else happens, I just want to be with you. That's the important thing. You know, whatever, you know.
Right, right. So I think we are going to carry a lot of our persona with us. So anyway, that's why I think that Yahweh doesn't tell us a lot about what life is going to be like in eternity. He gives us plenty of clues where we can surmise. But he's not going to bribe us. And then the other thing that I wanted to convey is that while I concur with you that Yahweh is fun to be around, and to be with him forever is reason enough to go. He seems to have a proclivity for forming relationships with people who are interested in learning, in growing. And so
our children. We don't want our children to sit around the house all day. We want them to go out and ride a bike.
That's good. Right. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Right. So this practice of ours to try to search out for what we might experience and to share what we might experience, the very thing that we're doing right now, I think is perfectly compatible with the kind of individual that's going to find heaven enjoyable.
Yes, assuming God probably makes some pretty amazing stuff to see. I mean, even on this earth, it's pretty amazing to tour the national parks and see the beauty of Yahweh's creation.
Of course.
And if here, then how much more there, you know?
Yeah, exactly. And I do want to. I want to have the 1,007 years. To explore this existing Earth, this existing solar system, this existing galaxy, this existing universe. There's some cool stuff. And I'm convinced that as excited as Yahweh is about life, that in the new universe, there will be all kinds of very interesting life. You know, there'll be a platypus out there someplace.
Yeah, I struggle with the notion of predation, you know, the carnivores and omnivores. The fact that one life form has to kill another, we have to have a food chain, it's like, it's kind of lamentable. I'm not quite sure about that.
Yeah, and, you know, I think that it was helpful in the design of humans to make us omnivores. But it was helpful for us to see and to witness and to participate in the idea that something dies for us to live, and that life is a very precious commodity. And so I rather think that the universe and life here on Earth, as it is with carnivores, is designed to teach us something. And I rather like it from that point of view. I've been talking during the breaks with Scott, who's going on a hunting trip with his father here before long, and both of our attitudes towards hunting, which is that neither of us are hunters. I've gone on safaris, but when I go on a safari, I take my camera. I don't like to kill. I have a farm, and we allow our employees to hunt on our farm. There's only two rules. Three rules. One is you cannot bait the animal. Number two is you can't let the animal suffer. If you're going to shoot an animal, it's got to be put out of its misery very quickly. And number three, you've got to be doing it not for sport, but for food. All that said, I'm not going to do it. I'd rather look at the deer than I would shoot the deer. We probably have similar attitudes in this regard. Welcome back to Shattering Mist. Now that we've talked about what is to come and what we will have the opportunity to enjoy, I want to just finish that story that we were talking about, and it is really a story. It's written in a fanciful way by Reuters regarding Jerusalem as it is now plagued with the disease of Islam. We shared prior to this transition that the streets of Abu Tor, which is called Al-Turi, were quickly aflame after Hijazi's killing. Now, Hijazi is the man who attempted to murder a Jew for speaking at and listening to a conference with young men and boys throwing rocks at Israeli police. So this is the mindset of Islam. It's why I say that you can't fix Islam. Here's a fellow that tried to kill another person. He gets killed in the process, and the Muslim boys are throwing rocks at the Israeli police as opposed to throwing rocks at the family of Hijazi, the would-be murderer. They're lighting fires, and they're blocking roads and promising revenge. Revenge for what? I mean, this reminds me to some degree of what happened in Ferguson and outside of St. Louis in Missouri, whereby a bad kid, a kid that's been on the wrong side of the law, a kid that was acting badly, a kid that threatened a store owner, robbed a store, and then threatened a cop, was killed because of his bad behavior. And yet you had activists come into Ferguson to make the boy who acted badly, who engaged in very inappropriate, illegal, immoral acts, out to be a hero, and made the police out to be the villain. It's when your judgment is that badly corrupted, you can't be effective at anything. You can't be helped. Well, that's the nature of Islam. That's what it does here. The Israeli forces have responded with stun grenades and tear gas while helicopters hovered overhead. Clashes went on into the night. It's not a clash. I mean, come on, folks. Wake up, Reuters. The Muslims tried to murder a Jew. And now the Muslims are rioting over the fact that the would-be assassin was killed, as opposed to being captured. Then these Muslims are saying, let them arrest us, let them shoot us, it doesn't matter. It's true, it doesn't matter. They have no life, said Hama Abu Ammar, 21, one of those involved in the fighting. A black and white checkered scarf and the type made famous by the Palestinian leader, the ugly one, Yasser Arafat, around his neck. Yeah, let them. Let them shoot them. That's an invitation. Shoot us. It doesn't matter. You're a Muslim. What does it matter? You know, when God says, you know, you need to eradicate people in the promised land that are infected with the disease of religion, that's what he's saying. Those diseased by religion know it. It doesn't matter. You can't help them. You can't fix them. Can't resolve their problem. You can't heal them. Put them out of their misery. At least we can frustrate them, slow them down, and they will know that we will never give up. If there is a low-level war underway, its driving force, according to this journalist, has become the ancient marble and stone compound that houses the Al-Aqsa Mosque, Islam's third holiest site, and the 7th century Dome of the Rock, the gold-plated shrine where the Prophet of Muhammad is said to have ascended to heaven. Wake up! Wake up! Muhammad dreamed it. Muhammad said that he went to the temple. The temple had been destroyed hundreds of years before his imaginary voyage. His wife, which was an act of pedophilia, is recorded saying he never left his bed. Muhammad didn't make it to Jerusalem. He didn't fly on a winged ass. Asses don't have wings. There was no temple there. And let's just say that in all imagination, that Muhammad performed the one miracle of his life and he made an ass fly. And then he got on his supersonic ass and made it to Jerusalem. And he actually flew back in time where there really was a temple. And he leapt up there to heaven. If you get to heaven through Jerusalem, which you do, it sort of negates everything that is Islam, including the Kaaba, including the Quran, including the Medina, including all of it. Wake up.